I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, Frank Capra is generally one of the most beloved filmmakers in Hollywood history. Thanks to films like Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and the holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life. Capra is often seen as being a champion of the working class, whose filmography celebrates the everyman, as opposed to the politicians, bankers, and others in positions of power. Our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, however, argues that this Capra, the great defender of the common man, is in fact a myth. Joseph McBride is a noted film historian who has written biographies of such legendary Hollywood figures as Steven Spielberg, John Ford, and Orson Welles, who, I should add, McBride collaborated with for the film The Other Side of Midnight. He's also the author of the 1992 Capra biography, Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, in which he discovered that contrary to the popular image, Frank Capra was not a champion of the everyman, but rather a lifelong Republican who disliked FDR, a xenophobe with anti-Semitic tendencies, and perhaps most shocking of all, a snitch who threw his fellow colleagues in Hollywood under the bus during the dark days of McCarthyism and the Red Scare. In his new follow-up to The Catastrophe of Success, entitled Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, Joseph McBride details the Kafkaesque tale of his struggle to tell the story of the real Frank Capra against the forces that sought to thwart his truth-telling efforts as a biographer. It's a book about what it means to, as the great reporter Walter Lippmann once said, tell the truth and shame the devil and the costs paid in doing so. And with that being said, let's jump right into the conversation with Joseph McBride, author of Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra. Welcome to Parallax Views, film historian Joseph McBride, author of Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, and the new, Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra. Once again, welcome to the show, Joseph McBride. How are you doing today?
Good, and good to be with you, JG. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's interesting. I really wanted to have you on the show to talk about this fascinating book, Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra. It's very different from a lot of other books. It's a bit hard to categorize. On one hand, it's sort of works as a sequel to your biography of Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success. But on the other, it's more about the ordeals faced by a biographer trying to tell the honest story of his subject. I want to get into that, but first, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and how you went from boyhood in Wisconsin to moving to Hollywood.
Yeah, my parents were journalists on the Milwaukee newspapers, and so I grew up in a journalistic family, and I sold my first magazine article when I was 12 in 1960, and I was also a volunteer for John F. Kennedy and his presidential campaign, which led me to write a book about his assassination called Into the Nightmare. And so I grew up as a writer. I've been doing that ever since. I started writing books in 1963, and that's what I enjoyed the most. And I was off writing screenplays for a while, too, but I kept writing books. And since 1984, I've concentrated on books. And since 2002, I've been teaching full-time and writing books at the same time. And it's a very rewarding combination of things to teach and go in and talk to young people and show films and discuss them and then come home and work on books. I really enjoy that. And so I've been a film historian since the 60s when the discipline was getting underway. And I think it began kind of with Orson Welles. I discovered him when I was 19 at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I began writing a book about him. And I usually write books because I think there's a need for it. There is not a book on the subject that, you know, I go to the bookstore and I can't find one. And so I figured, well, I better write one. My first book was on baseball, called High and Inside, An A to Z Guide to the Language of Baseball. I was a baseball fanatic, and I wanted a book on baseball slang, and there wasn't one. So I thought, well, I'll write one. And I had great fun teaching myself how to write a book on baseball. And the same thing with Welles. There wasn't much on him in English, and he was kind of an eclipse. And so I wrote this critical study of him that took 4 years. And through that, I got into a Welles film, The Other Side of the Wind, which finally came out in 2018. It took 48 years to come out. I started acting in it in 1970. He put me in because he wanted a funny, nerdy film critic, which I was. And it's a film about Hollywood. And so I got to play myself, and I acted for him for 5 years, which was an amazing experience. I'd never acted before. And I've done two other books on Welles. And then after I decided to stop writing screenplays, I focused on writing a major biography of Frank Capra, who I discovered was not the man he seemed to be. He was sort of a fraud. And I wrote an AFI tribute to him. I wrote those American Film Institute Life Achievement Award shows, which were my most rewarding work as a screenwriter. I wrote five of them for about Jimmy Stewart, Fred Astaire, Frank Capra, John Huston, and Lillian Gish, and I loved doing those. But in the course of doing the Capra tribute, I realized I got to know him better. I'd met him before, but I soon realized when I first met him in 1975 that he was much different from his public image. But I got to know him more deeply and people who worked with him, and I realized it was a great story there that had never been told. So I retired from screenwriting to write the Capra book, and that became quite an ordeal and saga, as I recounted the new book, frankly. And it took 7.5 years to get the book published. It took about, really, about 3 of the years were spent writing it, and about 4 of the years were spent fighting the legal battle to get the book out with my publisher, Alfred A. Knopf, part of Random House, and Capra's archivist, Janine Basinger of Wesleyan University, were trying to impede my book in every possible way. And I got it away from them and went to Simon & Schuster. It came out in 92. And all those years I wanted to tell this story, but I felt that the time had come. And so I spent a lot of time. I kept meticulous notes, and I went through all my notes. And since then, I've done biographies of John Ford and Steven Spielberg, and I did a critical study of the director Ernst Lubitsch. It came out last year called How Did Lubitsch Do It? So I'm a film historian, but I also write about American history and other subjects, and that's what I really enjoy doing.
If we could back up for a second before we get into the Capra books that you've done, were you always someone who was sort of in love with or sort of spellbound by cinema and Hollywood from a young age?
Yeah, I was a film buff back in my boyhood. We had a theater called the Tosa Theater. I grew up in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, which is a suburb of Milwaukee. And so I would go every weekend and watch, westerns and sci-fi movies and stuff, you know, like we did in the 50s. And every day on TV, there was a western at 4 o'clock on a show called Foreman Tom's Jamboree. And I was a huge western fan and still am. And I'm teaching westerns now. And then I'd go down on weekends to Milwaukee theaters. Back in those days, if you wanted to see a new big first-run film, you had to go downtown, you know, and everything has changed since then. But my father had passes for the downtown theater, so I would see the big films. And so I was quite a film buff. And then I kind of got out of that a bit because when I went to high school, I was working so hard on my studies that I didn't go to new movies for a few years. And when I got to Wisconsin, I was thinking of being a novelist and journalist. I always assumed I'd continue as a journalist, but I saw Citizen Kane in a film class in 1966 and changed my life because here's a guy who's 24 years old when he makes this tremendous film, and he's from Wisconsin, which appealed to me, and it's about newspapers, and I thought, wow, I'll write and direct films, and that shifted my whole life. It shows you what a college class can do. I tell my students that, and so I began working on this book on him, and that was what got me into film writing. And I wrote a lot of articles for film magazines over the years, and interviewed many, many directors. And I was really we only had 2 film courses in Madison, and once I took them, I had to kind of devise my own curriculum by running a film society and watching films all day long. We had an archive there, and writing screenplays. I also started writing screenplays and directing short films, and I was just really devoted. And eventually went to Hollywood in 1973, and I worked for Daily Variety, which was, I say my film school was Orson Welles and Daily Variety. And Daily Variety was great because I got to go on sets of films, which you can't really do much anymore. They discourage that. And I could watch films being shot. And I didn't have a very clear idea how films were shot back in Wisconsin. So I could go anywhere and interview any filmmaker I wanted. And one of the great things was a lot of the old, pioneers and veteran filmmakers from the silent period onward were still around and eager to talk. And so I made a point of interviewing all of them, and I did an interview book with Howard Hawks, which took 7 years, called Hawks on Hawks, and that was great fun. And I got to know Capra through Variety, and I put together all my best short stuff in a book called 2 Cheers for Hollywood that came out a couple of years ago. So I've done a tremendous amount of magazine articles and newspaper articles on film as well, and that was my education. And, it really helps to have a hands-on education if you're going to write screenplays or books of film history, as I do now, because a lot of writers who write books on film history are too theoretical, or they don't know much about the actual practice of making films. But there's nothing like working on a film and working in the trenches of Hollywood to to acquaint you with the hard reality of how a director with, or Ingmar Bergman said, what makes a great director is having a personal vision. And that is hard to maintain. I mean, you either have it or you don't, but you also have to fight for it. And that's what I deal with the directors who manage to succeed in doing that one way or the other.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because I feel as if, frankly, unmasking Frank Capra, in order to fully understand it, we have to understand that it's not simply a book about becoming disillusioned with Capra, but becoming disillusioned with Tinseltown itself in a lot of ways. And I think you sort of make that point early in the book that you became very disillusioned with New Hollywood after a period of time.
Yeah, that's very true. And as you get older, I suppose it's inevitable your work becomes more memoiristic. And I've written various books that are memoirs, and this is one because it's about my writing a book, which is an unusual thing to do, but it's, I think, a good story and a real saga. I think it's a kind of Kafka-esque black comedy, rather harrowing at times, but you know, has a happy ending because I got the book published. I won the battle over America's biggest publisher. But I was a big Capra fan, you know, like a lot of people, and I still like his films. The irony is that after exposing him as a fraud, basically, in many ways, I still admire his work as a director. And I think in our culture today, we have the inability to separate the man and the work to some extent. Obviously, they're related, but if you don't like somebody's personal behavior, and most artists are not exemplary citizens, people say, I'm never going to see a film by so-and-so again. But having known about Capra and where his conflicts reside, and you know, he stole credit from writers, and the writers deserve a lot more credit than they get, and that's part of my book. But he also was a terribly conflicted man, and that shows in his films. And for a long time, people were confused by his films politically and otherwise because they seem contradictory in some ways, and that intrigued me, and I wanted to find out why that happened, and I got the answers to that because I sort of, you know, I was part of the generation that created the auteur theory, or followed Truffaut and Andrew Saris in developing the auteur theory that the director is the dominant force in filmmaking. But we won the battle too well, in a sense, because people don't pay attention to the other collaborators, especially the writers. But having been a writer, it really sensitized me to screenwriters' contributions. So when I write about directors, I don't just give all the credit to them. I go into great detail on their relationships with the crew. And Capra's crew, for example, were among my best sources because those people really know how the film is made. And my first priority was to find out how he worked. And in his autobiography, The Name Above the Title, which is almost entirely a work of fiction, as I found out, even though it's a beloved book, he's very vague on his working methods, and it turned out very misleading. So I interviewed his cameraman, Joseph Walker, who shot 20 of his films, and Edward Burns, who was his sound man, and a bunch of other crew people who really gave me the accurate story. And I moved on from there. I interviewed everybody I could find who was around, and interviewed 175 people. And one thing I did that was unusual at the time, but I was inspired by good biographies like Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, and his great book on Robert Moses were role models, as well as Justin Kaplan's book on Mark Twain and some other ones, to interview so-called ordinary people who knew the subject, and not just stars. Because when I started, the typical film biography was they'd interview 8 or 10 movie stars, and that's about it, you know, very superficial. And movie actors, stars, often don't know an awful lot about the production because they come in for 2 weeks or a month, and they tend to be somewhat narcissistic and focused on themselves, whereas the crew people are with the film from day one to the end. And then you have all the other people involved, the writers and the executives and producers and people. And, you know, to get the real story is complicated. Plus, you need to research documents, and there's a tremendous paper trail on all of us, I discovered. And with Capra, not only did he have extensive papers at Wesleyan, which were extremely revealing, but I did everything possible, humanly possible, for 7.5 years to look up government documents, and I fought battles with the Freedom of Information Act with the Defense Department, the FBI, et cetera, to get his records. And that's part of the struggle I talk about in Frankly, you know, getting the records, because the archive was hiding some documents that I first read when I went there in 1981 to do the Capra AFI tribute. That's when I discovered that Frank Capra was an informer during the blacklist period. I found that out very quickly, because I isolated. I have a good eye for news, being an old newspaper guy. And there was a part of his book that troubled me. His career had a precipitous fall off after World War II. He made great films in the 30s, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, It Happened One Night. He was really on top of the world, and then he kind of fell apart after the war, and I wanted to know why.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but I wanted to note, for listeners that are unfamiliar with Frank Capra, if they're a bit younger, I think people will immediately recognize him for directing It's a Wonderful Life. As you mentioned, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. These were films that are seen as championing the working class in America, the masses, the common man. And yet you find out that he betrays so many of these ideals in his own life.
Yeah, that's what really was disillusioning for me. And, you know, the process of going to Hollywood and being in the film industry was very disillusioning. And I write about that in some detail because it's important to understand the context in which I wrote this book. It's a book about partly my disillusionment with Capra, who was a hero of mine and misguidedly, but also I was had kind of a rosy view of Hollywood that was unreal, and I was disabused of that by being a screenwriter and then you know, learning about Capra and other people. And I loved Capra's love of the common guy, although the way he put it was, he said, "I didn't think he was common. I thought he was a hell of a guy," which is an interesting comment, because they're not exactly common men in his films. They're kind of uncommon common men. You know, like Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is one of my favorite films, runs a statewide newspaper for boys, and he's head of a boys organization. He's very naive, but he's not just some average guy on the street. And Gary Cooper in Meet John Doe is an average baseball player in the Skids, although he is a baseball player. And Clark Gable's a newspaperman. I mean, they're working class people to some extent, but Mr. Deeds is a guy who owns a factory in his town, and he inherits $20 million, and he gives most of it away, but he's canny enough to keep $2 million of it. That tells you something. So there are all these qualifications in Capra films about, yeah, they're common men, but Capra distrusted the masses. He distrusted, in Capra films, the masses often become unruly mobs that you're supposed to be afraid of. And I found out that Capra was a lifelong Republican. People assumed he was a liberal, but he wasn't. He was very anti-liberal. He hated the New Deal. He hated Franklin D. Roosevelt. He admitted to me that's the word he used. And he's seen as the champion of the New Deal, and he was really not. But what people didn't understand, because the auteur theory gets in the way, a lot of the ideas in his films came from his writers, especially Robert Riskin wrote a lot of his great films, and Joe Swerling and Sidney Buckman and other people. And they were liberals or leftists, and Capra worked with communists. And one of his great strengths, as his closest aide told me, was he worked with people from all over the spectrum of politics. And he accommodated different points of view, and that is part of what a popular artist does. He responds to the public. And he was responding, and he actually said this, it was partly commercial calculation. The public wanted films about the Depression. They wanted films about average people and, you know, fighting the system. But it is very inspiring in his films, but it's complicated because sometimes these people fail or, they become corrupted, et cetera. And so Capra's films are not simple, which is part of what's good about them, and that's one reason I like them. But I can see now the reason for the contradictions, why in Mr. Smith there'll be some very radical scenes, and then there'll be some kind of right-wing lines would pop up, and because those were written by Frank Capra, and his right-wing friend Miles Connolly would throw in some lines, although the script itself was written by Sidney Bugman, who was actually a member of the Communist Party when he wrote the film. And Capra informed on him, as well as several other people, during the blacklist period when things got hot. The great irony and tragedy of Capra's life was there was really nobody more patriotic as an American. He was an immigrant from Sicily, and immigrants often feel more strongly about our country than people born here. So he really loved America, and yet he was portrayed as subversive after the war because he was a social critic to some extent in the 30s in his films. And he still upheld the system, but he criticized its flaws, and that's one reason we like those films. But a lot of that criticism was put in by his writers, but he was big enough to accept that and incorporate that. And he, part of him still connected with the poor working-class guy that he had been when he was struggling in his youth to succeed. So, and he was a great director of actors, and so he was able to really make you feel empathy and heart and struggle with guys like Jefferson Smith and Mr. Deeds and Gable's reporter and It Happened One Night. And so that persists. So I think I understand the films more, and therefore I think I like them more. So you can see the man in the films differently, and one enhances the other understanding. But unfortunately, there are a lot of Capra fans who don't want to hear the truth about him because it complicates their simple worldview of heroism, which is kind of a dangerous thing sometimes.
I think it makes for a better and more human story, and a story that actually connects to the broader story of America and the sort of contradictions within America and our values over the course of the 20th century. So I don't understand those criticisms. But it's interesting, you mentioned Sidney Bucman. There's a point where you talk about an exchange that he had with Sidney Bucman, which sort of reminded me of the sort of tense moments between Gore Vidal and William Buckley. I'm pretty sure you know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, there was a terrific documentary by Morgan Neville about the two guys. It's really worth watching. They would have debates about America on TV, and you know, they represented such diametrical points of view that makes for sharp debating. But yeah, Bucman, the story, it's a great story, and I found it in Bertrand Tavernier, who's a friend of mine, interviewed him for Positif in France, and Bucman had died before I came along. But when Bucman was writing Mr. Smith, he was a communist, and he later left the party, but he was blacklisted anyway. And he was working on the script, and Capra came in to see him, and Bucman said, The theme of the film that I'm writing is that in our democracy, you can't compromise even on the smallest principles because that's what the country is all about. And if you do, everything is lost. And he said, that's my theme. And Capra suddenly said, I don't know if I can use a four-letter word on the show. Can I?
No, go ahead.
Capra said, go get fucked with your theme. And Bucman was shocked. You know, this was, you know, all about democracy, and that's the film is supposed to uphold the Bill of Rights. You know, Jimmy Stewart's character very eloquently gives a filibuster about the Bill of Rights, and he says, go get fucked with your theme. And Bucman said, well, how can you say that? You who love Charles Dickens, Capra was a collector of rare books, and he owned Dickens's proof copy of A Christmas Carol, for example. And Bucman said, you know, Dickens was always for the poor and the underprivileged, and he said, yeah, he was an anti-Semite, but he fought for justice, and Capra just kind of looked at him and said, are you a communist? And Bucman said, are you a fascist? And we left it at that, he said. So he said Capra was always suspicious of him, that he would slip in some kind of communist propaganda into his film. It's a film that is intensely patriotic, but it's very critical of the American system. It shows most of Congress being corrupt and the system being loaded against an honest man and woman. Jean Arthur's character is really a great character, the secretary to the young senator. And she's the one who really knows what's going on, and she tells him what to do and educates him. It's a very feminist film in that sense, because you begin thinking, why isn't she the senator? But so it is very critical, and it provoked a backlash that kind of freaked Capra out, and it helped make him run for cover. It's one of the reasons he sort of began backing down from his stance as a political critic although he did meet John Doe the year 2 years later, which was a pretty strong film too. But then he went off to war, and I think that kind of ruined him as a creative artist, because he's submerged his individualism into just following orders, and he came back and there was nothing really left of him, or not much left. He did It's a Wonderful Life, but that was kind of his last gasp. But you know, this clash with Buckman shows that Capra didn't really, as Buckman said, he didn't think Capra really understood what the film was saying, which is bizarre, because in the auteur theory, you know, supposedly the director controls everything, but here's a director who didn't really agree with the point of view of the film. And to me, my favorite example is American Madness, a terrific film Capra directed in 1932. And that's the first of his really socially conscious films. It was written by Robert Riskin, and it's about a bank president who's unorthodox and loans money to little people and poor people and gets in trouble with his board. And it's a kind of a Roosevelt allegory, and it was made during the campaign when Roosevelt was campaigning for president. And Capra liked to claim credit for the story or the co-writing script, but I found out that was just false. Actually, another director started shooting and he was fired, and Capra came in and had very little to do with the script. But so Riskin provided the theme of that film, and that was the template. That and Platinum Blonde, another Riskin script, were the templates for the later films that I've been mentioning. And so there was, Riskin created a lot of the thematic content, as did Joe Swerling, another liberal writer who helped create the Capra worldview. And then Capra took it up. But he began feeling that he had to say, this was my doing. These were my ideas. He couldn't just be content with being a really good director. He had to be the writer. And that's a problem that afflicts a lot of directors. And it comes from insecurity, I found out. Capra was actually insecure about being a director. He didn't think it was as important as being a writer. He actually told me that. And he said writing a book is more important than directing film. And part of it was that he started as a screenwriter, and I read his early scripts in his collection at Wesleyan University, and they're not very good. He was a good gag writer in the 20s, but he was sort of a failed screenwriter, and he became a director as a kind of a second best occupation, and he always felt sort of insecure about that. And then he had some pushback, like his mother, who was very tough on him, never really understood what he did as a director. He said that she didn't get how he could be making all this money just by sitting in a chair, is the way he put it. And when Mr. Smith was finished, he thought, well, this will finally impress my mother. So he had a screening at Columbia, and he had a car pull up with her, and they met her with roses. And she came out, and he said, well, Ma, what did you think? And she said, Frankie, when are you going to get a job? Can you imagine? So he never really totally accepted that he was just a director, but his reaction was to promote it like hell, and he hired a publicist, and he was one of the leaders of promoting what became the auteur theory. And the more insecure he was, the more he trumpeted his own contribution. But by going into the archives and interviewing people and reading all the materials, you find out who contributed what and how Capra was not the total author of his work. I think film is a multi-authorship medium. It's a collaborative medium. Even the greatest directors are influenced mightily by their screenwriters, like John Ford was by Frank Nugent, Dudley Nichols, and people like that. But the great directors control the work, you know, and they're responsible for what goes into the film, and they hire the people. But that doesn't mean that they have all the ideas themselves. And that got him in trouble after the war. That's the irony, is these left-wing writers, mostly left-wingers he'd worked with, either liberals or communists, he was accused of various subversive acts after the war when the Red Scare came. And some were absurd, like you supported Russia during World War II. Well, of course, they were our allies, and he was working for the army, and why wouldn't he? But one charge was hard to answer because it was true, which is you were associated with a lot of left-wing writers, and that's guilt by association. And it's also not, you know, we have to remember about the blacklist. It's not a crime, according to the Constitution, to be a communist. But it was treated that way back then. And so he panicked and to save his own skin, he lost his security clearance on a Defense Department think tank at Caltech, his alma mater. So he panicked and turned in several of his colleagues and said they were communists, or he suspected they were communists. And he hid this from public knowledge. Most people, you know, everybody knew that Ilya Kazan was an informer because he did it publicly, and he took out an advertisement in the New York Times justifying himself. And he became a very controversial figure, love him or hate him, but at least he had the guts to, you know, openly talk about it. And Capra didn't. Capra hid the secret because he was ashamed of it, but he preserved the evidence in his collection. And I think that was a subconscious form of confession. So I come along in 1981 and find this document. And the point I was going to make was, when I went to the archives the first time to research the AFI show, there was a point in his autobiography that seemed jarring. After the war, I was trying to find out why his work declined. He goes to India in 1951, and he was at a film festival representing the State Department, and he was very stridently anti-communist in a way that seemed stupid and unkeeping of his previous work, and I wondered what happened. So I asked for the box for that period, and I found this security board file where he was informing to the Defense Department. So within 30 minutes, I basically had the story, but it took 7.5 years to get it all documented and worked out. But then they hid that document. Jeanine Basinger, the archivist, who promised me a lot of cooperation, hid that document because I made the mistake of telling her about it. I thought she might be interested.
It just disappeared at one point.
Yeah, she had two copies of it, and she claimed she didn't have any anymore, and she gave one back to Capra. She didn't admit she had two, and then I found out that Capra didn't ask for it back, and I finally got it from the FBI, or I'm sorry, the Defense Department. I had to file Freedom of Information Act requests and appeals for 7 years. And I finally got the document, but it took a tremendous amount of doing, and there were all kinds of legal battles behind the scenes between me and Knopf, and my editors at Knopf were working against me, trying to thwart this book. Robert Gottlieb was my editor. He's a very illustrious editor, still working, and he's Robert Caro's editor, and Caro is somebody I admire a lot, who did the Johnson biography, still working on the latest volume, and the Robert Moses book, which I think is the best nonfiction book I've ever read. But Gottlieb got in with Jeanine Basinger. They became friendly, and they were in cahoots to thwart my book. And I knew I was in trouble early on when Gottlieb said, "You know it all, you may know too much." And he said, "When you turn in the manuscript, the slasher will go to work. You will regret you ever met me." And I was really shocked that the editor of a book could say, "You know it all, you may know too much." First of all, how did he know that I knew it all, even though I did? Second of all, how could you know too much? I mean, isn't that the job of a biographer? And so she was warning him, and I warned him about her, and instead of supporting me, he started working with her to throw up obstacles, and they started not exactly denying permission, but they put up all kinds of roadblocks to my getting permission to quote from unpublished materials and things, and they never really gave permission. So I wound up having to cut a lot of quotes from Capra out of my book, but I I summarized things that Capra said, and actually I think it helped the book because it streamlined the book, and also I felt I could say it better than he did in my more pithy language, I thought. And but I had to rewrite the book. It took a lot of work, but the basic story is all there. And but it took a tremendous amount of legal maneuvering, and it was sort of like three-dimensional chess that I was playing for years, and it really took a toll on me financially and physically, and on my wife Ruth O'Hara, who is extremely supportive and a brilliant legal tactician too, and she came up with a lot of ways of countering them that thwarted them. And my lawyer, Maury Mealy, and my brother, Mike McBride, who was a lawyer, and we all worked together, and we finally wrestled them into submission and got the book away from Random House, but it took years to do that.
And it eventually got released by Simon & Schuster, and
right.
Also was, you know, critically acclaimed and praised, roundly praised.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. You don't know, you know, after all these years, you know, I was kind of shell-shocked. I didn't know what kind of reception it would get, but it got great reviews, really long, thoughtful, really praising reviews. And, you know, I go into that in the book, and I also go into the inevitable backlash. There was sort of an academic backlash because I was upsetting the entire picture of Capra. Most writers on Capra had believed his autobiography, and there's almost nothing in that book that checks out as true. I checked every fact, which was good discipline.
Who was the one reviewer when that book initially came out that said, "Oh, this is there's something fishy going on here"? You mentioned him in the book.
Oh, when Capra's book came out in 71, Elliot Stein reviewed it for Sight and Sound, and he wrote a really interesting, funny, trenchant attack on the book. Because he sensed very shrewdly, you know, the lies and the evasions and the just garbled facts. I mean, I found out that Capra did only 2 days of research for the book. Can you imagine? He went to the Directors Guild and the Academy Library for 2 days and the Beverly Hills Public Library, and that was about it. And so he was going off memories and his scrapbooks that his wife kept. And, you know, that's no way to do a book. Even your autobiography should be thoroughly researched. Like Catherine Graham's autobiography has a lot of evasion in it, but I give her credit for she hired a research assistant. They interviewed 200 people about her life, and all of us, when you think about your life, there's a lot of about your life you don't know. Like Capra told me, well, there's a lot about my parents I didn't know that you're finding out. For example, he said, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know what your parents are doing. And I love his family. The saga of an immigrant family always moves me. And he didn't like his family very much, and so that's part of the story. But, you know, he didn't do the research, and so therefore the book is slipshod. But Elliot Stein figured it out. And I have to admit, when I read Stein's review in 71, I was kind of miffed because I thought he was being too harsh on Capra. But if anything, I realized he was being, you know, not he wasn't being soft on Capra, but he could have said a lot more. But I did all the legwork to nail down all the lies and evasions.
And just to put this into context, you mentioned the blacklist. And I want people to know, because we're so far removed now, it feels like, from that era of McCarthyism, although we may be seeing a little bit of a neo-McCarthyism in our own time now. But that's yeah. Beside the point. I want to nail home to people that the House on Un-American Activities and the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, these organizations, they put people's careers on the line. They ended careers. People like Dalton Trumbo couldn't work in Hollywood under their own name. This was really a dangerous time for people in Hollywood. And as you point out, when you told people at the AFI that, you know, you found out that Capra was a snitch during the blacklist, there was one person at AFI that said, "We would have never done a tribute." This was very, very serious stuff.
Yeah, that later became an issue when they were thinking of giving Kazan their award, and he didn't get it for that reason. But Gene Furstenberg was the director of the AFI who told me that you know, if we had known that he was an informer, we wouldn't have given him the award. So it's a serious battle. And when Kazan got an honorary Oscar, I was one of the people outside protesting, and I helped organize some of the protest. And Kazan was a great director, like Capra was, but he, you know, giving a life achievement award is recognizing your whole career and everything it means. And I think that's where the line could be drawn. But I at the time I did the Capra show, I just found that out, and it was a struggle to write that show. And I don't think it turned out too well because it's conflicted. And my producer, George Stevens Jr., really didn't like Capra very much. His father, George Stevens, the great director, was a liberal, and he was against the blacklist, and he and Capra had a falling out. And that was part of George's background with Capra. And he just didn't like his films, and the editor of the show didn't like his films, and I liked the films. But I was trying to get more reality into the show, and George would say, "No, we can't say that." For example, Capra admitted that he had sold phony mining stock as a young man, you know, defrauding farmers and people of their money. And I wanted to mention that in the biographical film we did. And he said, "Well, you can't put that in because people will say, how come this guy's not in jail?" I mean, you know, that's part of the point. And Capra said, in his autobiography, said, "I hated America as a kid," and I wanted to quote that, and George said, "Well, you can't say that on the show." So the show became kind of bland, and that's another reason I was impelled to write the biography. Okay, let's really get into it and tell the unvarnished truth. And it's important for us to know that about our cultural icons. And part of what makes, frankly, I think, interesting and important is that it shows you the tremendous struggle it is in America. We think of ourselves as a semi-free country with the First Amendment, and yet it's very, very hard to tell the truth about revered public figures who have a myth surrounding them, as a lot of them do. You get such pushback. You know, look what happened with Oliver Stone and JFK, et cetera. And, people get very furious when their myths are punctured. And Frank Capra is beloved by a lot of people as some kind of a Gandhi-like guru, which is far from the truth. He was a real misanthrope and very bigoted. And that was another thing that shocked me, was he was continually... I interviewed him for over a year for the book, and this is after I interviewed him on previous occasions. But I really got him focused on a lot of his issues. And he would make all kinds of bigoted remarks about any ethnic group you can name.
He would go on about the Jews
in Hollywood, he claimed, were sabotaging his career. And he said the only black people he liked were athletes and entertainers. Can you imagine? And Native Americans he didn't like. He didn't like Mexicans. I mean, he didn't even like Italians, his own ethnic group. And, you know, it's just, he was an equal opportunity hater. At least he hated everybody. But he had this image as this guy who loved everybody. And one thing I thought was a very telling moment on the AFI show, I wrote his acceptance speech with him for 2 months and rehearsed it, because George said, "Capra's not a great public speaker, so the show will rise and fall on his speech." And so I rehearsed it over and over with him. It was really interesting. And at one point, he came in with... some lines. He said, "The secret of the Capra of my work is two things: the love of people and the freedom of each individual." He said, "That's the formula upon which I based all my work." And I thought about it, and I said, "Well, you know, formula doesn't sound so good. Why don't we call it principle?" He said, "Oh, okay, great, principle." And then I realized later it was a formula for him. He didn't really believe in the equal importance of each individual and the freedom of each individual. There was a formula that he got from Robert Riskin, and he followed it. So I was kind of helping create the Capra myth without meaning to, by making it more palatable, calling it a principle, which is, you know, makes him look better. And I wish now maybe I'd just let him say formula.
Another really telling moment in the story that sort of, it sort of sets you off in a way into... maybe digging more into Capra is the Gerald Ford story.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, that was the first meeting I had with him. And in 1975, this really enlightened me and led to the book. I went to, you know, I was saying that on Variety, I got access to every director I wanted to. And so I went to Palm Springs to interview Capra with the excuse of gathering material. I wanted to get material for his advance obituary. I was writing advance obituaries to people, but I really wanted to just meet him and talk to him. And he was very cordial. We went to lunch at a country club, and he was giving me his Frank Capra rap about how he hated bankers and rich people, you know. And this guy comes over the table, you know, a very conservative looking man, and he had a bunch of photographs, and he said, "Frank, here are the pictures of you playing golf with President Ford." And he spread them out on the table, and there were these nice shots. One of them I thought was very striking. Was the president holding the pin while Capra putted. And I thought, that's really the immigrant fantasy right there. The president holds the pin while you putt. That's so great. And Capra was saying, "Oh, isn't that wonderful? Jerry Ford's such a great guy. And, oh, gosh, so terrific." And the guy said, "I'll make copies of them and give them to you next week." And Frank said, "Great." And then the man left, and Capra turned to me, and he said, "Where was I?" And he said, "Oh, yeah. I was telling you how I hate bankers and rich people." And then he launched back into his routine. And I immediately thought, wow, there's a real contradiction here. This man is two-faced. He's not the man he seems. And I made a sort of mental note, find out more. And it took years for me to break away from Hollywood as a screenwriter, which was difficult for me to do psychologically. But I began, and then in 81, 82, I got to know Capra and his associates better. And I realized there was a great story here that had never been told by the media. They had been snowed by him for 40 or more years. And he was great at manipulating the media, and the media helped create this myth of this man of the people. And so I had a scoop, and that kept me going throughout all the struggle. That and the love of the craft, it was such a fast, and the complexity of this man. He was like a Dostoevsky character. And every day I felt stimulated working on the book, even though the legal battles consumed so much of my time.
It's very interesting to me that Capra comes from an immigrant background, and yet he seems to have this difficulty with integrating that into his identity, as opposed to, say, a filmmaker like Steven Spielberg, who was able to deal with his identity. Maybe you could comment on the role that identity plays in unmasking Capra.
Well, it's interesting, and I guess it was while I was, maybe a bit before I wrote, frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, I suddenly realized the common thread that runs through my three biographies of Capra, Ford, and Spielberg, which is ethnic identity. And, it's funny that, this is probably true of most writers. You write things for personal reasons. You don't always know why. And I've always been interested in ethnic identity. I'm Irish American, and our family's always been proud of that. But when I was a kid, we were raised with this melting pot ideal that we were all supposed to sort of blend our, boil down our differences into what is thought to be an American, whatever that is. And so therefore you were, the corollary, unfortunately, is you're supposed to be ashamed of your background as an Irish person or an Italian or African American or whatever. That was the prevailing attitude. And that's not a healthy thing, in my opinion, that we should celebrate our past and our distinctions, and, but not to hold them against other people. But Alex Haley's roots changed all that. I could see that happening. Suddenly people took pride in their background and thought, isn't it wonderful that we now know our history of our family? And so that became a huge thing with Ancestry.com, and everybody studying their histories, and they're proud of their ethnic backgrounds, and they have parades and museums and all kinds of stuff. But Capra came along before that, and he was ashamed of being an Italian immigrant. And, to put it in context, when I did a long chapter on his high school years, which I thought was very critical because that was the first time he moved out of his, he thought he grew up in an Italian ghetto, which I found out was not true, but I had to go to Washington and get the census records and then interview people. It was a multi-ethnic neighborhood, but it was mostly immigrants and struggling people, and he didn't like that. He wanted to be where the action was with the rich people in Pasadena, and started hanging out more and more with well-off people and looking down on his own family. That's one of the really sad things in the book. I liked his family. The people I met were terrific, and the ones who had died I thought were wonderful people. And his first wife was Jewish, and he despised her partly because she liked his immigrant Italian family. Can you imagine? And so I said to him once, when did you get over being ashamed of your parents? And he said, I haven't yet. I thought that was very telling. And I read a book on Italian immigration that came out at that time, and it said one of the tragedies of immigrants in that era, and this is probably true to some extent today, is that the younger generation, which assimilates more easily and learns English more easily, often feels embarrassed or ashamed of their parents, who can't adapt as easily or don't want to. And that was Capra's problem. So he disassociated himself from his family, and he projected himself through heroes who were WASPs like Jimmy Stewart and Gary Cooper. They were not ethnic, short Italian guys like him. And he was being something he was not, to be accepted in America. And then Ford took a very opposite path, because he was super proud of being Irish, and he grew up in a multi-ethnic background too, but neighborhood. But that was actually something that is reflected in his films. He's He always has ethnic minority groups in his films, and they're treated with affection, sometimes stereotypically, but they're always in the films and part of the fabric of society, whereas Capra's work is very white and waspish. And when he has black characters, they're really put down and caricatured. But Ford's black characters are more complex. And so I realized I was exploring a different kind of approach in that book. And then Spielberg, as you mentioned, he said he was ashamed of being Jewish when he was a kid because he was persecuted or shunned to some extent for being Jewish. And he was born in Cincinnati, which is has a lot of Jewish background there. And but they moved from into progressively more waspish towns, and there are five places he lived, so I had to research five different areas, and they got more and more away from the Jewish background, and he was ashamed of it, and he was trying to escape, and he wanted to be popular, and that's why he's a great popular artist, like Capra, in that he was trying to be accepted by the majority, and he was doing his best to be welcomed and accepted, and he had common man heroes too, but sometimes they were played by Jewish actors like Richard Dreyfuss, for example. And so he was flirting with his identity in his films, but he didn't fully accept it until he did Schindler's List. And that was such a triumph for him in every way. He really reached beyond himself and made a really great film that everybody, well, not everybody liked, but most people liked. There was a backlash against that too, but he put it all together, accepted who he was, which I think is a very healthy thing for anybody to do. And if, for an artist, it's extremely valuable because you integrate your life and work in a way that is fruitful, and that helps account for his dealing well with difficult subjects in the films that have followed Schindler's List. And so to me, the three of those filmmakers offer contrasts in how to deal with your ethnic background. And I realized that when I was a kid in Wisconsin, I grew up in a town that was very German, Milwaukee. And, but, you know, I was proud of being Irish, but then I went to the University of Wisconsin where I was kind of ostracized and I didn't fit in very well. And I was sort of felt alienated from my Wisconsin roots. I was thinking that Wisconsin was kind of a farm state. I didn't have much connection with that. I came from a city and a sort of intellectual background. I was kind of snobbish myself about farmers and all this. You know, I was kind of ashamed of being from Wisconsin. And I realized I was wrong and stupid after a while. And so I had to wrestle with being ostracized and finding my path. You know, I fell in with a film group, which was my niche, and that's when I started being happy in Madison. And then I went to Hollywood where, you know, the film world, and although I had some problems in Hollywood fitting in too, but, you know, that became a big issue in my life, and so I think I became fascinated by that. And so when I found Capra, he was an example of what not to do. He was a cautionary tale of don't run away from your past or your identity on a larger scale. It's not just your ethnic background, it's who you are as a person.
Well, I mean, he fabricated his educational credentials. I mean, in a lot of ways, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I don't see Capra as the villain of this story. I see people like Gottlieb and Basinger as being the real villains. To me, Capra is sort of, you humanize him by telling the truth about him, and he comes off as a much sadder but more human character than the mythic hero that we get in the sort of mythology about him.
Yeah, I kind of like the guy a lot. I mean, I had a lot of warmth toward him. He's a very warm and fun man to be with, but he also had a, you know, kind of cold streak as well. But yeah, he fabricated, for example, part of his myth, and I keep reading, even though my book disproves some of these things. One thing that seems trivial, but it's not, is that he claimed he was had a degree in chemical engineering from Caltech and only became a director because there weren't any jobs after the war for scientists. And it's just not true. I found out he got a BS degree, which was a general degree that was like their least degree. And he didn't get a chemical engineering degree because he was not good enough. He didn't do well in those advanced courses. And he started doing poorly in his junior and senior years partly because his father died in a farming accident, partly because he found a girlfriend, which he never wanted to admit, but I found her. And so his interests were turning toward film, but film was not a respected profession back then. It was very déclassé. And he fell into it as the second best occupation because he was a failure as a scientist. And so when he's crowing about getting an engineering degree, it's a way of saying, I was really important, but I chose to go into film anyway. And people see that as a kind of a tribute to film, but that was not the reality of it. But you keep reading this myth all the time. And he inflated his credentials it was just part of his general pattern of lying about who he was throughout his whole life that I was constantly debunking. And he was just never happy with being who he was and just saying, okay, this is who I am. I'm a Republican. I don't like Roosevelt. He had to hide all these facts. And then what I think he did, though, by giving his papers to the university, which his wife kept, I said, why is it that there aren't more good biographies of movie directors? He said, because they didn't have wives who saved everything like mine did, which I thought was an interesting comment. She was a secretary, Lou Capra. And maybe in her subversive subconscious, she was undermining him by exposing him to it. But by giving his papers to Wesleyan, he was confessing in a way. He left the evidence of his transgressions there for somebody to come along and find. And I came along, and his archivist, I don't even think, knew what was in the papers, Janine Basinger. She hadn't opened the boxes until I came along, and she was shocked by what I was discovering and then tried to, belatedly cover it up, which is something unethical for an archivist to do. And I think he enjoyed the process of confessing to some extent. It was a contentious thing to interview him because sometimes he would be very open and candid, but it became like a game we played. I had to find out. At first he would lie about something, and then I'd go and interview somebody like some woman he knew in college who would talk about going on a date with Capra or something. And I would go back and say, well, you claim you didn't have a girlfriend, but this woman said you were necking in the front seat. Well, she was, in the back seat with some guy. And then Capra would tell me the truth, and he remembered it really well. And he said, yeah, but she was making out really crazily in the back seat, And so then he would tell me the truth. But I had to find it out on my own by digging up documents and interviewing people, and then he would tell the truth. So I think he enjoyed that process, but I felt kind of like a priest, hearing his confession. And it was a struggle for him to, part of him wanted to hide it, and part of him wanted to confess. People have parts, and that's what I was dealing with. That's what makes for an interesting character.
Just real briefly, there were maybe two more things I wanted to mention. You mentioned auteur theory. And I guess Capra would often say, one man, one film, and he would sort of take all credit for it, his films. And it's interesting to me because I think that belies sort of his illiberal or anti-left-wing streak, because I think, if you have a more left-leaning or liberal mentality about things, maybe you'll see film as being more of a collaborative effort rather than a dictatorial effort by one director sort of controlling everything as like a puppet master. I think that's telling that he was such a big supporter of auteur theory.
Well, that's a really good insight, because you think of Renoir, for example, who's one of my favorite directors, and a film like La Marseillaise, his great film of the French Revolution, was made in collaboration with, they actually subscribed, the public paid money to make the film, and Renoir worked closely with writers and actors, and there's no shame in giving credit to people. It's not a zero-sum game. If you say, yeah, my writer really is a huge help, and I love these actors, and it doesn't really detract from your work as a director, but in Capra's mind it did. But you're right that it's an autocratic attitude that he fostered, and the auteur theory could be criticized for that as creating this myth of this dominant individual, usually a male. And now we're focusing more on all the neglected women directors in film history, and I've been teaching courses on women directors. But there's this kind of feeling that directors are like kings, and in America too, we treat our president like a king, and that's not the way it's supposed to work in a so-called democracy. But you know, when you really study films, Alan Pakula, I did a couple books of AFI seminars I edited, and Pakula, who directed All the President's Men, said, the best thing about films is that it's collaborative, and the worst thing about films is that it's collaborative. And I use that as the epigraph because it is exciting to collaborate with people, but somebody has to be in charge for the film to be good, and somebody has to make decisions. And Capra told me the reason he stopped directing is that all a director does is make decisions, you know, 100 decisions a day, he said, and I couldn't do that anymore. And I realized in studying blacklist victims and informers that informers, I even knew some of them, had trouble making decisions because when you made decisions, you had to live with them. You had to take responsibility, and some of the decisions they made and Capra made were terribly wrong. And so you get spooked by the fact that, gosh, I better not make a decision. And so Capra couldn't do that anymore, and his films degenerated, his projects. And one of the saddest things I read in his papers, all these projects that he was trying to do in his later years, he made very few films in his last years in Hollywood. And I read scripts of many projects and treatments, and they were mostly terrible. And he wouldn't work with liberals. He actually said that, I won't work with liberal writers anymore. And when you say that, that means you can't work with like 90% of the writers in Hollywood who are liberals. And so he mostly worked with Miles Connolly, who was this right-wing nut who helped bring out some of the worst qualities of Capra. He also influenced him early on in some good ways, but then he was pushing him towards strident anti-communism and sort of simple-minded storylines, and the studios were kind of aghast. And Capra also found religion. He was a Catholic, and then he left the church, and he was a Christian Scientist for a while. But in 52, he went back to the church. Partly, you know, he's running for cover from his guilt. He kind of blacklisted himself. He left Hollywood in a hurry in 1951 when HUAC was prowling around, and he got out of his contract and went to Fallbrook and ran an avocado ranch, and he was not happy there, and he tried to make a comeback in Hollywood, but he basically blacklisted himself, and he was miserable, but he was inactive. The point about religion was he had a lot of projects that were religious in the 50s, and they were embarrassing, mostly, and the studios would be embarrassed, like The Life of St. Paul starring Frank Sinatra. That's one I'd like to see, actually. I think that might have been interesting. But he had a lot of those kind of projects. They were making Bible movies and things, but they were Capra's rendition of these things was mostly pious and simple-minded. There, one that he wanted to do would have been good was The Life of Saint Joseph. John Fante, who was a very good writer, wrote a script called The Carpenter of God, and the whole idea is Saint Joseph is this humble carpenter, and his virgin wife comes to him and says, "I'm pregnant," and the father is a Holy Spirit. And the human dilemma of this guy faced with this crazy story, how does he deal with it? That would have been a good film, and it's a very interesting script. But The Legion of Decency was horrifying, so Capra dropped it. And that's kind of a typical of the later Capra. He was afraid of something that would have been a good film, you know?
It's interesting. You mentioned the avocado ranch. It's sort of a footnote within the book, frankly, but you mentioned that he even supported sort of big ranchers over the common folk where he lived after retiring out of Hollywood.
Yeah, that was a big surprise. The only time he was in public life, political life, he was he was part of the water board in Fallbrook where he lived, and it doesn't sound very exciting, but as he wrote himself, there's no more important issue in that area than water. And we've now learned that in terms of, you know, climate change and things, that California especially depends on water. And so they wanted to build a dam. And this is so much like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I uncovered this whole story in his papers, and then I interviewed people there. People wanted to build a dam there, and Capra was one of the big landowners, ironically. He was a plutocrat, and he was upset that the government wanted to dam the river and take over some of his land, and he fought it, and he was fighting the little ranchers and farmers formed a group, and Capra was one of the big ranchers who was against them. So he was totally on the side of the rich guys against the little guys, which is the reverse of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. The only time this had been mentioned in a book on Capra, it totally reversed it. It said he was fighting for the little guys against the big ranchers, which is what you'd expect, but that was because the writer didn't know anything about it. But he was on the side of the villains, and this became glaringly obvious, but in the town, and it didn't get much beyond Fallbrook, but there was a grand jury investigation that made Capra look bad, and I found the documents. And this, but what was particularly interesting too was this is what made him flee back to Hollywood, that there was such bad blood there about this controversy that he kind of scurried back to Hollywood and really didn't want to do it, but he tried to make a comeback and was miserable for the next several years trying to flog various projects. But so it was an important part of the book, and my editor wondered, well, why are you writing about his public service? And I said, well, first of all, it's the only time he was in public office, and second of all, it contradicted his myth, and also it led him back to Hollywood, so it is a pivotal episode.
It seems like his life really was, as you put it in your first biography of him, the catastrophe of success. It really was that. He didn't seem to be able to hold it together as he gained this massive success. He didn't really know how to be both the filmmaker and the political pundit that was championing the masses.
Yeah, that's a great insight, and I really think that's part of the tragedy was here's a guy who was a good journeyman filmmaker, made some very fine films in different genres, and then he makes It Happened One Night, which was a surprise success and won all five big Oscars and made him a world figure in 1934, and he wasn't prepared for it. And then he had this ambition to make films on bigger subjects, and that was part of his downfall because he got pretentious. But he saw himself as a pundit, and people come to you then. He said, people in the interior of Asia know who you are, for example. That's very daunting. But people would come to him and ask his opinion on world politics in the 30s and national issues and philosophical issues. And he was not prepared for that. He wasn't well educated in that sense. He went to an engineering school, after all, and his education was spotty. He wasn't versed in political science or history. He had simple-minded views on these subjects. And he, unfortunately, fell into a trap by getting all mixed up about his political views, and he was mixed up already being a Republican working with left-wing writers, and he didn't know how to handle all these contradictions. And then when he got backlash for Mr. Smith and other films, he panicked and ran for cover into the army, where he liked following orders because it relieved him of the responsibility for thinking for himself. And when he came back, he made It's Wonderful Life, which is a pretty good film, but it, in my opinion, is flawed by its recourse to the supernatural to solve human problems. Before the war, people had to work out their own solutions, and even though he had somewhat fanciful happy endings, at least the films were grounded more in reality. But Wonderful Life is a fairy tale. It's very appealing, but that was sort of the end for him. He made that one pretty good film, and then after that, it was just awful filmmaking. He had said all he had to say, but he was not prepared for being a pundit. And I have to hand it to Spielberg, for example, whose education was not very good either. He was a poor student. He was dyslexic. He didn't care about the university education he got because all he cared about was making films. But somehow he's able to make films on important issues and handle them with diplomacy and understanding. And he listens to people and he gets good research, and he's intelligent, he makes Munich, he makes Schindler's List, and makes public statements, and he's intelligent about what he says, and he gets into controversies, but he knows what he's saying, whereas Capra would just put his foot in his mouth and make things worse. But Capra didn't seem to have a moral grounding, as all these stories I've been telling about his family would indicate, that any man who's ashamed of his own family and wants to disassociate himself from them has a real problem, and disassociate himself from his identity, whereas Spielberg embraced his identity, and that made him a whole person, I think, and Ford always did that. And so Ford could deal with some very complex political issues. He knew what he was doing, whereas Capra really didn't. And I studied again his early films before he became the socially conscious filmmaker, and there's a lot of good work back there. Those unpretentious films he made in the 20s and early 30s, and but he wasn't satisfied with that. He wanted to make social statements, and that was his undoing. And Alastair Cook, the pundit, wrote when Capra was doing Lost Horizon, he said, "I have the uneasy feeling Capra's on the way out. He's starting to make films about ideas instead of people." And that was a very prescient comment. Lost Horizon is a very muddled film. It's appealing in some ways, but kind of ridiculous in other ways. And it was a disaster for Capra. That was really his Heaven's Gate. He went wild. He was a rather frugal filmmaker, but he started shooting way too much footage and bankrupted the studio. It caused him tremendous trouble, and the studio recut the film, and he was very bitter about that. And he was never the same after that. He just didn't have the control of his own impulses that somebody like Ford had, who was much more professional. Capra just kind of went bonkers, trying to be pretentious, and he wasn't cut out for it, and that was part of his tragedy. So you have a life that's about 45 years of success and 45 years of failure. And I do compress the later part because, if you went day by day through the later part, it would be extremely monotonous and depressing. So the last part was the hardest to write because I had to condense a lot into short space, but I tried to deal with themes, the general broad themes of what went wrong. And it's a classical tragedy of a great man who has a deep flaw or flaws and destroys himself in the process.
Well, I mean, capsulizing it, I would say that what's most fascinating about it is he wants to do these social commentary films. He wants to say something. But then when he does, and this whole time he considers himself a great patriot. He loves America. But when he starts making these social commentary films, he's accused of being a subversive. And he feels betrayed by that America he loves so much. And he starts betraying the values that he would promote in a film like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he throws all these people under the bus during the witch hunts.
Yeah, that's a great summary of the book there in a couple sentences. That really, it is a tragedy. He loved America. He was a great patriot, and he had good reasons for loving America, and America kicked him in the teeth and let him down. And the real heroes of the blacklist, the only people who really came out of it with dignity were people who were blacklisted or left the business. If you were in Hollywood working, you had to compromise in some way, shape, or form. And I guess, Capra left the business voluntarily, but before he did it, he surreptitiously informed. And, you have to say he was ashamed of it, I think, because he fled and he was guilty enough to hide the evidence of his informing. It's an interesting moral question to compare him with Kazan. Kazan bragged about informing and made it public and took the heat for it, and Capra lied and covered it up. Now, who's the worse person or the better person? I don't know. It's an interesting question. Capra did ultimately confess by releasing the documents, and then Jeanine Basinger and Robert Gottlieb tried to stop me from telling the truth. They wanted to really gut the book and remove me from the process and re-edit the book and take out most of the political things. And they even installed an editor at one point without telling me. It's kind of unbelievable that a publisher would do this. And I found out who this person was, and I confronted her. And that's helped lead to getting me away from Knopf. They behaved so badly. But, it was a real saga in how un-American, is betrayed by his country, and then he betrays his ideals, and he betrays the ideals of the Bill of Rights, which, when you see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I just showed that in a film class. It's a very inspiring film in many ways, and I feel very stirred by it, as most people do. And he believed in those theories to some extent, but when they come into practice, it's difficult. I mean, a lot of Americans today don't like the First Amendment because it's, if you really believe in it, you have to support opinion. You have to support people's right to their opinion, even if you disagree with it. And that's not easy for some people to do. So they're very quick to say, well, somebody should not publish this book, or, let's blacklist Woody Allen, even though he's never been found guilty of any crime. You know, he can't get a film shown in America. He can't get his autobiography published. We're back in a kind of McCarthy period, as you were saying. And we have to adhere to the values, as Sidney Buckman said, even the smallest things, and those are not small things, but there are many things that happen every day that we have to stand up against. And Capra wasn't prepared to do that. He was kind of a coward, unfortunately, and gave in, and he felt terrible about it, and he felt guilty, and he lacked the fortitude to be himself, and that's part of the cautionary tale of my biography. And so unraveling that and then telling the story of how I discovered that in the book, I go through all the processes by which I unraveled the truth, and then all the trouble I ran into for trying to get the truth out. It tells you a lot about America, too, and the state of publishing, that you'd think that biographies that are frank and revealing would be of interest to people, and they usually are, but I think there are probably many stories that we don't hear about, and some biographers and other people have come forward since I wrote my book and told me, yeah, I had a problem with a book that, you know, sometimes these books never see the light of day, and I was fortunate. I was extremely persistent. The Washington Post just did a piece on me and said I was one of the most persistent people in the country, which I was happy to read, because I just wouldn't accept that this book wouldn't come out. And I fought and fought and fought, and it was a tremendous sacrifice and struggle, but it was worth it. And, you know, that's what it's all about. If you're a writer, it's a battle, and you have to fight for your work.
That's the last thing I was going to ask you, was why did it matter so much to you to tell the truth? I mean, I keep thinking of the Walter Lippmann line, tell the truth and shame the devil. That's what every good journalist has to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's true of biographers as well. This seems to have mattered a lot to you.
Yeah. Finley Peter Dunne, too, the humorist, said journalism should be about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And I had that in mind, too. I've been a journalist from 1960 on. I think it meant so much to me, partly because I was writing about Hollywood, and Hollywood let me down. I went there sort of naively, like a Jimmy Stewart character, expecting I could make great films. And I realized they didn't want serious films, and they were afraid of social issues. And I realized after a while, I was ignorant of the blacklist when I arrived, but the blacklist still permeated Hollywood and still does. The fear people have of dealing with controversial issues, that's one reason films are so bland. You get in trouble when you deal with them. And so I was let down and betrayed by Hollywood, I felt. And Capra, I felt, let me down in a sense that he was a hero of mine, and I realized I was wrong to treat him like a hero, because he was not one. And he was a liar, and he was a fabricator, and he was a traitor to his friends, and let down his own country, and, you know, betrayed all the values that we thought he was promoting in his films. And so I felt this was my book about Hollywood, and that's one reason why, and frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, I write about myself and what led up to this book as a screenwriter, you know, facing all the compromises and difficulties that you run into. And I had a lot of interesting political films that I wanted to make that they were horrified. You know, like I had a Fidel Castro biography I wanted to do. That would have been really a good film. But there, could you imagine going in to try to sell that? They were looking at me like I was crazy. But so when somebody like Oliver Stone comes along and gets political films made, it's a miracle. But even he has had tremendous trouble since JFK. He's had important films like My Lai Massacre and Martin Luther King's Assassination that they won't let him do. So I was thinking, you know, when I was struggling in Hollywood, thinking about all these issues, and then I began focusing on Frank Capra as a symbolic figure. And he covered the whole history of Hollywood from the silent days to the 60s and into the 70s and 80s. He was still running around, you know, giving interviews and speeches. And so he was a representative figure of how Hollywood went wrong and let down the public. And we've seen it. It's gotten even worse. You know, this great art form that partly was developed in Hollywood, you know, is turned into trash mostly today. And it's a medium for adolescent young males mostly. And, but they're not making very many serious good films. It's a real, real struggle to get one made. And it's partly because of the cowardice of people like Capra and the blacklist and the intimidation. And so this was a story that meant so much to me on a personal level because I'd been through some of that. I didn't suffer as much as the people who were blacklisted, a lot of whom I knew, like Abraham Plotsky and people like that. But I was struggling with some of the same prejudices and battles in Hollywood that they went through. And here was Capra, who was supposed to be a champion of civil liberties and First Amendment. He was not. He was a fraud. And so that represented so much of Hollywood to me that I felt compelled to tell it. But, you know, once you try to tell a story and people are trying to stop you, I didn't want to be stopped. I wanted to get the truth out. And I was willing to put everything I had into it financially and physically and psychologically. And I had good support. And prevailed, but I'm very stubborn, and I wasn't about to give in on this book, and that's what Frankly is all about. And so I think that's a good story, and it is a cautionary tale. If you're going to write a biography, I'd recommend you read that book to realize what you can get into. And I made some mistakes along the way. I told Jeanine Basinger what I was discovering early on, and that was a mistake, and trusted Robert Gottlieb, and that was a mistake. But
you did make sure to do it an unauthorized biography rather than an authorized one, which, as much as unauthorized biographies get flack, I think they can get at the truth more than the authorized ones.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about that, because once you authorize a book, as Robert Gottlieb himself told me, he said there's always a price to be paid. And he said falsely to me, he said, I would never have bought your book if it was authorized. And then I found out, as I was fighting my legal battle with him and Knopf, that I would look at their biographies, and almost all of them are authorized, you know. And often the author would say something like, well, this book is authorized, but the family really had no control and they didn't read the manuscript. That's just probably a lie. So a lot of biographies are authorized, and you make compromises and sell out if you do that, because, you know, to let somebody censor the work is intolerable for me. And I think, as members of the reading public, I wouldn't, you know, I don't trust books like that, and I want to hear the true story. And so many books that I read are full of evasions and fabrications and just outright lies. And so the ones that come along that are truthful, you really value. But the author has to fight for that. And so I just, on principle, refused to write an authorized biography. I never would dream of that. So the Ford book and the Spielberg book were unauthorized. And, you know, I had a few problems along the way, although Spielberg, ironically, was probably the best to deal with. He wouldn't give me an interview. He claimed he's saving it for his autobiography, but, you know, whether he will ever do that, I don't know. But he's a control freak, and I'm a control freak. And so he wouldn't give me an interview. But when people called his office to say, should we talk to McBride, they were told I was kosher, which I thought was nice, because it opened some doors. So that I appreciated that. He told his mother not to talk to me. I guess your mother knows all the really bad stories. And I chatted with her briefly. She's a very nice lady. But I did get an interview with his father, which was remarkable. But Stephen didn't know about that at the time. His father just gave me the interview. And but, you know, that was the easiest one to do in that sense. Ford gave me an interview. He was rather contentious, but he gave me an interview. And I had a few problems in that book, but I persist and I get these books done, but I would never let somebody control them. And that's one reason, Frankly, is self-published. I believe in self-publishing with difficult subjects. I've had three books published that I've done on my own through my Hightower Press imprint that I've created. My book on the Kennedy assassination and the murder of Officer Tippit, Into the Nightmare, and my memoir of The Broken Places are dream projects that I wanted to do. And I didn't want anybody to tell me, no, you can't say that, and you can't do that, and you got to cut that out. So when you self-publish, you sell them through Amazon so everybody can buy them, but you have complete control of the content of the books. And I still do books with regular publishers, like my Lubitsch book was done through Columbia University Press, and I'm doing a book on Billy Wilder now. It's a critical study, and I expect that I'll have a regular publisher for that. But with the
Frankly, you'll be covering Sunset Boulevard in the Billy Wilder.
Oh, I love that film. That's, you know, when I went to Hollywood, I actually thought films about screenwriters tended to be too dark and jaded. And then I went to Hollywood and I found out that Sunset Boulevard is like a documentary. I told Billy Wilder, and he said, well, it's a Valentine. I love that comment. He said, every industry has this slush under it if you look at it. But, you know, it's a cautionary tale. I should have taken those films more seriously. It is really one of the great films. Every screenwriter identifies with Joe Gillis, the poor guy who always wanted a swimming pool and winds up dead in the swimming pool. And I was wrestling with those kind of issues before I liberated myself from Hollywood in 1984. I've been much happier ever since, writing books and teaching.
You know, there was just something that came to me off the top of my head. One of the really haunting parts of, frankly, for me, and maybe this is how we can wrap everything up with a nice little bow. The thing that always gets me is throughout the book, you make a few references to a quote by John Cassavetes, the independent filmmaker. He's been very championed by a lot of people over the years, but he once said, maybe there really wasn't an America. Maybe it was only Frank Capra. Why do you feel that quote is so important? Why did you include it?
Yeah, I think that's a very eloquent quote. It's very touching in a way. And before I learned the truth about Capra, I thought that's a wonderful thing to say. But I think there's more complexity in that quote than when you first encounter it. When you think about it, maybe there really wasn't an America. So he's expressing some doubt about the myth of America. Maybe there was only Frank Capra, and that implies that Capra helped create this myth of America that we live by. And America, Gore Vidal called us the United States of amnesia. You know, there's this kind of vast ignorance about our history to some extent. I see that with young people. And the media lie to us, the mainstream media lie to us a lot about our history. And that's why I wrote the JFK Tippett book, because we've been lied to on that subject from the mainstream media. But the hope is the internet and books are more honest usually than newspapers. And so there are books and internet sites and podcasts like this where you can get alternate views of history. But so I think Cassavetes was getting at some of that complexity, that it is a tribute to Capra that he helps create America and immigrants. You know, I mean, as John F. Kennedy said, we're a nation of immigrants, except for Native Americans who may have come from Asia themselves. But immigrants create a lot of what this country means. And they, as Catherine Hepburn said to me when I interviewed her about Capra, she said, people like me who were born here, we take it for granted, but people like Capra care more about America than we do. And that's to his credit. He felt very deeply. He didn't take it. He took it to heart, and yet then he betrayed it after it betrayed him. You know, it let him down. He didn't find a way of dealing with those problems. But I think that there is that view of America that Capra represents is very important. So that again makes his story bigger than one man's story. It's about an immigrant trying to understand this new country and fit in. And my wife, Ruth O'Hara, is an immigrant from Ireland, and she helped me understand that while writing the book, but she had a certain sympathy for Capra struggling with what it's like to try to be an American and fit in while keeping your identity, or, you know, in his case, he tried to deny his identity, but that was partly his undoing. But he didn't trust America enough, and I guess some immigrants have good reason not to trust America. And so it's a very complex portrait of American life seen from an outsider's point of view, who is desperately trying to be an insider. And so Cassavetes' quote kind of gets into that to some extent.
You know, I'm going to have you on the program again if you're open to it in the future. We didn't even get to your great collaboration with Orson Welles. But I like to end on a positive note. If there's anything you can say in regards to the type of people that are drawn to shattering myths and being truth tellers, any advice you could give or any sort of positive vibes you can give to my listeners to close out the program?
Well, I think of myself, the reason I'm like that is that I was lied to so much as a kid systematically. I was raised as a Catholic and I had to leave the church when I was 19. My two things that have saved my life are leaving the Catholic Church and leaving Hollywood film industry, both of which saved my life. I wouldn't be here today, if I hadn't done those. because I was lied to about American history and about human behavior and, you know, all kinds of things. And so I grew up with this tremendous passion to find out the truth behind the false stories that we live with every day. And that's why I became a journalist. And I was interviewed a few years ago by San Francisco State. They did a profile of me for, you know, they did faculty profiles. And the filmmaker said, "How do you see yourself?" And I said, "As an investigative reporter." And that's what I really am. And so then my candidate who I campaigned for was murdered, John F. Kennedy, and that was a shattering experience and made me, I wanted to go into politics, and then I became a writer instead. And so I that's my guiding passion in life, is find out the truth behind the lies. And there was a documentary made about me by a former student of mine called Behind the Curtain. I suggested that title. That's what I do, is look behind the curtain. And I think we should all do that, and I teach in my courses students to be critical of the media and try to understand the world, and you can't do it by getting it all from one news source. You have to have many sources and think for yourself and combine and not take anything at face value. And that's been good for me as a writer, whether it's writing about Kennedy or Capra or whatever, is don't take any story or document at face value. You have to look at the whole picture, and then you have to make some decisions, and Robert Caro's books help me in that regard. That he has a strong thesis behind his books because he thinks for himself, and he has some flaws. But, I mean, generally, you have to have a view of the world that you develop on your own, and you can't just take it from other people. I'd say that's what I would advise anybody who wants to be a writer or just a good citizen, is study it carefully, study many sources, and make up your own mind.
Well, Joseph McBride, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. If you have a website or a way for listeners to get a hold of the book, Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra, which I want to note, I think this is a much bigger story that you tell than merely the myth of Frank Capra. You're exposing the myths of America in a way, and the need to tell the truth and the cost involved in doing so.
Well, thank you. I do have a website, franklycapra.com. I have another one, josephmcbridefilm.com, where I post some of my articles, and intothenightmare.com, you know, articles and photographs and things, and thebrokenplaces.info, twocheersforhollywood.net. So I do a website for each book, and I post a lot of free material, and you can read some of this online, and hopefully it'll draw you to the books. But anyway, I hope people read the books, and I think, frankly, it's a good story that will engross people. And then they, you know, they can read the Capra biography too. And I just found it a great story as a journalist. I thought, I'm onto a great story. I'm very lucky. I have a scoop here, and that kept me going. And one reviewer said there's a surprise on every page, and that's kind of how I felt every day. You know, through all the struggles, it kept me going to have a story to tell that's worth telling.
I would add to that Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, I think it'll make a great movie of its own one day.
Well, thank you. I've actually had offers that I've turned down from people, feelers, to make a film of it. It could make a good movie, but I just wouldn't want to see it as a movie, because partly because of the struggle I had getting the film out, I wouldn't want to have somebody else take it over. And, you know, I mean, the mere idea of somebody else taking my baby over and turning it into their whatever they do with it would be not appealing to me. So I keep turning down offers. But thank you for the thought. Capra's story is a great story, great American story.
Well, again, thank you for coming on Parallax Views, Joseph McBride.
Thank you so much. It was really a good interview, and thank you for all the great questions.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with film historian Joseph McBride on his book, Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra. The release of this episode so close to Christmas felt rather apropos, given that Capra directed the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life. Speaking of the holidays, I should have a holiday special out for listeners on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, so look forward to that. Also, be sure to check out Joseph McBride's book, Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, and let me know what you thought of this edition of the show by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, by the time you're hearing this, I should have the latest edition of Parallax Views the Week that was available for my Patreon supporters. So if you enjoy the program, please consider supporting me on Patreon. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.